Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Banking Matters. For those of you who are chiming in for the first time today, I'm your host, Daniel Baker. I have been with Compliance Alliance for the past 2 years as an associate general counsel. Prior to joining CA, I have worked in a variety of different compliance and audit positions. Joining us today, we have Lori Trogdon. Lori serves as the president and CEO of the Arkansas Bankers Association. She has a Bachelor's of Arts in Political Science from the University of Central Arkansas, a Master's of Science in Operations Management from the University of Arkansas, and is an ASAE Certified Association Executive. Lori serves as the Chairman of the Board for the Graduate School of Banking at Madison, Wisconsin, a Trustee for the Graduate School of Banking at LSU, Economics Arkansas Executive Committee, Arkansas Capital Corporation Executive Committee, State Alliance of Banking Associations Executive Committee, American Bank PAC Board of Directors, and the American Society of Association Executives Government Relations Committee. With her wealth of experience, we're excited to have her join us today. Welcome to our show, Lori.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, before we jump into our topics for the day, I like to give our guests the opportunity to really introduce themselves. And I always like to ask, what was it that got you into this world of banking? What is it that got you to where you are today?
Well, I actually started out in corporate America. I worked for two different Fortune 500 companies doing HR work for 8 years. So, stranger to compliance and things like that. I spent a lot of time working on policy and things like that. So I did that for 8 years. And then I worked for a telecommunications company, and Verizon Wireless came in and bought them. And so being a mid-level manager, I thought I'd probably better go ahead and start looking, and found a position as the associate executive director for the Arkansas Bar Association. So I worked with lawyers for about 10 years. And again, no stranger to legal work, legal issues, laws, statutes, things like that. So had a good training there on all of those kinds of things and on running an association and how a C6 nonprofit works. So took that experience and parlayed it over to the Arkansas Bankers Association when the president and CEO position became available. I've been here a little over 4 years now. I really enjoy working with bankers, despite the fact that this is one of the most heavily regulated industries. All in all, people are very positive. They're upbeat. They're gracious and caring and really want to protect our industry and protect their customers at the same time.
Well, it sounds like the Arkansas Bankers Association is lucky to have you, and we're glad that you were able to join us today. So that really kind of brings us into our first question. I mean, there's been a lot of changes in the market, a lot of changes with what's going on. We've been seeing a lot of regulatory focus recently, speaking of a highly regulated industry, on representment fees, especially from the FDIC. This is a major issue, with some instances resulting in UDAP violations. How do you really see this issue evolving? How do you see this issue continuing to impact banks? What do you see going on here?
Well, I think it comes from two fronts, this issue. First, you have the litigation aspect of it, and then you have the regulatory aspect of it. And litigation actually started first. So I think the first instance of that was in around 2018 or so, and that's when you started seeing these cookie cutter class action lawsuits about banks' deposit agreements with their customers. And the difference in interpreting literally one or two words of, you know, transaction and things like that. So those have been happening throughout the U.S. And I'm here in Arkansas, obviously, and I know there have been instances of cases here as well. And so that at some point that piqued the FDIC and the CFPB's interest. The CFPB has put out some blog posts and things like that on it, but the FDIC has been the most involved with the examinations. And as you mentioned earlier, in some instances, UDAP citations for violation. And so those are the two, it's running a parallel track there with those two things. But the biggest thing was they put it into the FDIC put this into their examination manual without ever letting banks know there had been a change, or really telling them what they were doing wrong necessarily or how to correct it. Finally, in August of 22, the FDIC did issue a memorandum on it. And so at least banks had a little bit more guidance on it, but still issues still prevail with that. I literally talked to one of my member banks last week who had just gone through an FDIC examination and was well aware that this issue was going to come up because now it's coming up in every exam, and called me beforehand and said, you know, what do I say? What do I tell them? What's going on? And so all I could do is relay information from other bankers that have already had that exam. And I connected him with some other bankers that had already had that exam so he could hear about their experience. But the, as reported by him, the examiner actually told him, well, it's not that you've been doing it wrong. It's that we've changed our interpretation. And, you know, how do you really even respond to that when basically they're saying you're doing it wrong? So there's a lot of that sort of thing going on. I still get questions all the time of what am I supposed to be doing? Because right now what I'm hearing is that they're being told, if you'll go ahead and do a 2-year look back and make reparations of all the NSF fees that you've charged, then, you know, maybe we won't cite you for UDAP. Although if we think it's been a little too much, maybe we may ask you to go 5 years back, and then maybe we won't cite you for UDAP. So it's not, it's a lose-lose, you know, pretty much situation. They want to do the right thing by their customers, obviously, but, you know, they have no control over when the merchant reruns these things. Their systems just aren't set up to do that. The cores are not set up to do that, to flag those in the system and try to kick those back out. And the FDIC has readily acknowledged this in public, that they know the cores can't do this. There's no way other than, you know, banks printing out millions of records and going through them line by line on an Excel spreadsheet to figure out when this has happened, how it's happened. Then they have to go back and give the customer the money back, which only makes litigation worse because all of a sudden the customer thinks, oh, I've been wronged. So, you know, let's go find a lawyer. And unfortunately, it's not been wrong. This policy, this has been in place for a long time, and the FDIC has passed them on those examinations year after year after year with these same policies in place. So I think that it will continue to get a lot of attention. I'll say that a couple of weeks ago, us, along with the American Bankers Association, worked with Congressman Fritz Hill on the issue, and there was a hearing where regulatory agency heads were at the hearing, and Congressman Hill actually asked them about this issue in the hearing, because we, along with him, do not feel like the FDIC went through this process appropriately. They did not go through the actual rulemaking process. Like I said, they just changed the manual without notification, right. No notification, and also no implementation period. So we feel, and he feels as well, that that was outside of the rulemaking process. And so they didn't have the authority to make that change. And so he is, now that the House has changed parties, I think we'll see a little more of that type of hearing, trying to get to the bottom of, you know, what's going on with this? How do we correct this to make it right for citizens and to make it right for the industry without just, you know, putting these arbitrary examination procedures in place. So I see that going forward. Whether or not there will be some legislation around this, I don't know. With the two chambers being controlled by different parties, we don't really know what's going to happen at all these next 2 years. So that remains to be seen. As far as what banks can do right now, the best advice that I can give, and this comes from others as well, is review your customer agreements with your legal counsel, whether that's in-house counsel or outside counsel. But review that, make sure what you've got written in your policy aligns with your practices. And if you think it needs to be a little better defined, then do that. And obviously, banks are well aware of what notices they have to give and things like that. Banks could review their processes for alerting customers when their balance is going negative. The online banking portal and things like that are available, and just look at how you're communicating that to your customers, or if there's anything else that you might could add that might make a difference there. Also, when you are in these exams and you are talking to the examiners, you know, let them know, here are our limitations. We don't have the ability to run this, or we don't have the ability to catch this. It's going to be different at every bank, depending on the size of bank you are, the infrastructure you have in place, whether you have your own in-house processes and procedures, or whether you're dependent on a third-party vendor that does those sort of things for you. So explain to your regulator what's going on and, you know, try to work with that as best you can. And then lastly, I would say, as far as the litigation goes, be sure that you get in writing that the attorney that contacts you for records is actually working with one of your customers, because, you know, it could just be an attorney that's out there fishing for a class action lawsuit or something like that. So be sure and do that. And then, you know, think about putting an arbitration clause in your deposit agreements.
Yeah, I think all those are very good things. I really like the one that you mentioned about just kind of having that open dialogue with your regulator. And I think that's really what a lot of it's going to come down to on the day-to-day elements, just because you can do all the disclosing that you want. You can do all of that, but there are limitations to this, and it's incredibly difficult to have the expectation of having to go back and look line upon line, as you were saying, for like 2 to 5 years to see just what, where happened and everything like that. So having that open conversation, I think, is just very important moving forward. And then just being proactive with communicating to customers, like when fees are due and everything like that. I really appreciate that. Well, with the substantial changes that have been going on, there's another one that the regulators kind of threw a curveball at us. So I should say the courts threw a curveball at us, because the regulators had made the change and the courts came back and threw it back at them. And so these are – what I'm talking about specifically here is Regulation C or HMDA with the closed and loan reporting threshold. So the threshold was set by the 2020 rule, was vacated, and the reporting threshold was returned back to 25 loans. What type of responses are you expecting from regulators and banks, and what steps do you think banks should be taking at this point regarding that?
One of the big things is the additional data points. You know, currently Congress requires 13 data points on these loans, and the CFPB then added 8 additional data points with this rule. So 21 in all that have to be collected, and that's whether it becomes a loan or not. Those have to be collected, and all those have, not all of them, but many of those have subparts. So it's, you know, 19A, 19B, 19F. So it's not really just 21 data points. It's quite a few more than that. And so that really does impose a significant burden on your small community banks. The American Bankers Association did a study that showed for banks that are estimated around $580 million and below, the CFPB said, oh, it's only going to cost about $7,000 a year to do all these reportings and things like that. And it's actually closer to $40,000 a year for these institutions. And so that's a, you know, that could be a full-time position that never goes away, that then they have to absorb all that cost and, you know, new vendors and new things like that to implemented it within their infrastructure, you know, and larger banks have to build a system too, just like everybody else does. So they take on that internal cost if they're building those systems in-house. And, you know, the software that they do have, with which they get through a vendor, they're at that vendor's mercy as to when that software is updated, as to how it is updated, if you don't have your own internal program. And so you may be waiting, you know, 6-8 months before they can ever implement it. And then you have to go in and test it and do all the things. As we all know, when you get a new software in place, it's not just flip the switch and it works just right immediately. I wish it was for my software as well that I use in the association, but that's just not the case. And so they're also at the mercy of all of that, which, you know, again, only complicates the process, only adds to the expense. So that's a big issue there. We would just ask, you know, go back to the 13 data points. The 13 data points, you know, banks are set up for that. They know that. They know how to do that. Adding those 8 additional without congressional authority just wasn't necessary. The second thing I would say is the data integrity. We're concerned about the data integrity. While the rule covers both banks and non-banks, only banks are examined on this reporting. And so you really have no idea what the non-banks are doing, how they're reporting it. And so that weakens the data integrity. That's the first spot where it weakens the data integrity. The second thing is that this rule requires the lender to ask for race and ethnicity in their data collection. And often, you know, borrowers may not want to put that on an application. And mm-hmm. so if they choose not, which Congress said they don't have to put that on the application. And if they choose not to do that, the CFPB rule is saying, well, then you have to make your best guess based on your observation of them and their surname, which again speaks to data integrity. I know that I certainly want to be put in that position to make that kind of call. And again, your non-banks that aren't being, examined on this, who knows what they could be doing with that because nobody's looking at it. So that again, just skews the data and with community development and fair lending, if that's the goal here, if you have skewed data, that's really not going to help you. All that really does is give the reporter a nice, big, fat, juicy, controversial headline to say, oh, look what's happening mm-hmm. over here, which may or may not be correct at all. So it really doesn't help at the end. All it does is impose burdens and give bad data for that. And then our third point of big concern is privacy. The CFPB has said all of this data will be public until it decides what to redact. And it's not going to decide what to redact until after everything has been implemented. So it's going to be up to a year after it's implemented. It's not a month mm-hmm. or two. It's going to be, so this data will be out there.
Plenty of time.
Terrifying, right, for quite a bit of time. Unprotected. And, you know, from what I've seen or from what I've read, there are two data points specifically that easily can tie the data back to who the small business is, just based mm-hmm. on what they are. And so you can tie it back. You can go and you can look at that small business and see pretty much everything about them, about their loan and this and that. And so that can easily be used for fraud. The privacy of the small business and the small business owner, they have no control over what's happening with their data. And I think that's so huge in this country right now. We hear that every day. I want control of my data. I want, you know, there are privacy, a billion privacy laws out there to protect people's data. And this data is just going to be sitting out there for anyone to see. And aggregators can gather this data and use it however they want. And small businesses just have no protection right now with this. So those are really our main three components. There are many other things, but just to give a broad scope of that. And as far as what banks can be doing right now, I would say you need to talk with your vendors, talk with your core, map out how you're going to do all of this. And the other thing would be to help us continue to lobby Congress that they should, you know, this wasn't your intent and you need to step in and say, hey, we want this to be done a little differently. It took a lawsuit to actually get this implemented. It happened many, many years ago in Dodd-Frank, and we've not had these eight mm-hmm. extra data points all this time. And so I think we could take a little more time to make sure that things like I've just talked about, the integrity and the privacy, are protected. But the biggest thing is to start, you know, if you haven't already, definitely start working with your vendors and things like that and internal processes and procedures.
Which is, I really appreciate the fact that you're bringing it up where we're taking your time, making sure we're doing it the right way. And that actually, we were going to talk about cannabis a little bit, but if you don't mind, I'd like to pose one final question to you before we let you go. And the question I'd like to ask is if you could give bank's advice in today's market. Today's market is very volatile. Like, it's changing. Rates have been going up. There's been massive fluctuation. Like, the market's going to do great. The market's not going to do great. What kind of advice would you give to a small bank or a mid-sized bank in today's environment? Like, what really should they be doing on? What should their focuses be on?
Well, one thing I always say is utilize one major resource you have, and that is your association. Our job every day is to help identify what these issues are and to help try and solve them and to help lobby Congress and even at our state level. We are advocates every single day for, you know, what's good, what's bad, what needs to be changed. And so we keep our pulse on that for you. And we have, you know, we're members of other associations and organizations that also help us provide those resources, and we provide training. And, you know, just recently The first week of January, we did an economic forum for our CEOs and CFOs, where we brought in out-of-state speakers, an economist from DC that specifically talked about what you just asked me about. So we try to keep our pulse on that. And so I think that's something that sometimes may get overlooked, is that your association is there specifically for that purpose. And so turn to us and let us help you as far as that's concerned. And you know, banks have all the different departments that are watching different things. But, you know, we provide those resources. And then we also have our endorsed vendors, such as Compliance Alliance, that are also there to help with that. With, you know, if you don't have a compliance, you know, you need a second compliance person, or you need half of a compliance person, or you're in between compliance folks, you know, your virtual compliance assistant, that's perfect for that. And we can point you that direction and say, oh, you need that. I know where you can go to get that. And so, you know, if it's not something we can do in-house, we have those relationships in place to get you to the right place.
I love that, because getting involved with your bankers association and really getting to know your association in your individual state, I think goes a long way, because, I mean, you're there for a reason, right? You've been established for a reason. You're there to look out for the banks, to help the banks in any way that you can. So I think that's a fantastic thing, because you've got simply resources and tools and things that some of these small and mid-sized banks just don't. They just won't have access to. Well, all right, we really appreciate you joining us today. It's been very nice kind of get to hear from you and some of your experiences. We enjoy that you've been able to talk over some of these concepts that are just really hitting the market and the banking industry today. For the rest of you, thank you very much for chiming into today's broadcast. And that's Banking Matters.